Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Susan Shand, Alice Bryant, and Phil Dierking. But first, this report.
David Mshek and Marta Plominska have not always agreed on where their educational or career paths might take them. Both students are from Poland. Mshek was born 28 years ago in the city of Jaworzno. Plominska, age 25, was born in Radziankow. Both are musicians. Mshek plays trombone, while Plominska plays another wind instrument, the flute. The two had been in a relationship for several years when Mshek earned a master's degree at the Academy of Music in Krakow. He completed his studies in 2014. At that time, Plominska still had a few years left in her own master's degree program at the Academy of Music. But Mshek could not wait to continue his education. He felt any delay would limit him from pushing his abilities as a musician even further. About 10 years earlier, Mshek had visited the United States and enjoyed his time there. So he decided he wanted to attend an American college or university. However, Plominska had no desire to leave Europe. In the end, Mshek was admitted to a 2-year program at Columbus State University in Columbus, Georgia. He began studying there on his own in 2015.
But Mshek and Plominska would not let their differences nor the distance end their relationship. In 2016, they decided to eventually get married. And once Plominska earned her master's degree, she agreed to come to the U.S. and give its higher education system a try. From her very first day in Georgia, Plominska says there were major difficulties she had to overcome. For example, Krakow has a large public transportation system, which many locals use, while Columbus has only a few buses. Without a car, she and Mshek found it hard to do what, back in Poland, had been some of the simplest things, such as going to a store to buy food. But Plominska says she also noted a major difference in the behavior of Americans compared to the people back home.
The people in US, they are really smiling a lot, I think. They're smiling on the street when they pass you, and they usually can say, like, how are you? Which will never happen to you in Europe.
Slowly, these and other qualities of life in the U.S. began to make Plominska enjoy herself, she says. Then, enjoying life as an international student became even more important. Both she and Mshek agreed that they would need to continue their education after completing their studies at Columbus State in 2017. The two knew that to perfect their musical abilities and find university teaching positions or jobs as performers, they needed to earn doctoral degrees. That is when they learned about the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, or UNLV. UNLV is a public research university that was established in 1957. It serves about 30,400 students. The city of Las Vegas is well known as a place for people to visit while on vacation, while Nevada is famous for its gaming industry. Las Vegas has many casinos and large hotels, where some of the most popular entertainers from around the world perform. And there is a saying that expresses the culture of partying there. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Mzhek admits that he had never heard of UNLV before he began considering doctoral degree programs. Yet, he says he was pleased to find that many professors teaching at the school came from well-respected universities. However, Mzhek says he and Pluminska had a difficult start in Nevada, just like they did in Georgia.
We didn't have the best start in Las Vegas because our bikes were stolen after 2 weeks, I think, when we moved in. And then our neighbors below, they were evicted because of some reasons we don't know, really.
Las Vegas does not have the country's highest crime rate. But the Federal Bureau of Investigation did report over 4,900 violent crimes there in 2017. And Mzhek and Plominska say they did feel unsafe at times. Anastasia Motiti shares their concerns. The 23-year-old UNLV student is from Nicosia, the largest city on the island of Cyprus. Growing up, she says, her community was so closely connected that there was little fear of crime. So she felt a little unprepared for what life was like in Las Vegas. In 2016, Motiti earned a bachelor's degree at Emporia State University in Emporia, Kansas. Her degree program was in musical performance. Like Plominska, Motiti plays the flute. She learned about the school through the Fulbright program, the U.S. government's main program for international student exchanges.
Motiti says she liked the American method of higher education, which lets students take classes in both their major and other subjects. So she decided to seek a master's degree at UNLV immediately after completing her bachelor's degree. Once Motiti moved to Las Vegas, she says, it took her time to learn to pay close attention to her surroundings in order to stay safe. But she adds that life as a UNLV student soon made it so that she had little time to go anywhere or do anything outside of schoolwork. For music students, earning any sort of master's or doctoral degree means hours and hours of playing one's instrument, says Motiti. But more than that, she feels that her studies helped expand her knowledge and skills beyond just playing the flute. Now she has experience writing music and leading other performers. Motiti recalls that one professor showed her different kinds of music she had never enjoyed before.
He introduced me to opera, which is for me now is much better than theater, than movies, because it combines everything literally. I was blind to it, and then suddenly I come here and this person just shows me how I want to continue.
David Mzhek and Marta Plominska agree that they now spend much of their week on the grounds of UNLV, especially in the music building. They say that, in a way, it is good for their relationship since they are both studying in such an intense program. Mzhek and Plominska hold positions as teaching assistants at UNLV. They agree that teaching makes them look at their music and their own playing in ways they might not have considered a few years ago. And they say this adds to the list of ways the school helps them reach their goal of being the best musicians they can be. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Welcome to Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore common expressions in American English. Like all languages, our expressions come from everywhere. They come from nature, sports, and food. They come from money, culture, music, history. If you name the area, we can find a special word or expression that comes from it. The word we will talk about today comes from technology, bandwidth. The first definition of bandwidth is the range of frequencies within a given band, especially when used for sending an electronic signal. In computing, it means the largest amount of data that can be passed along a specific path. For example, if you are making a video on your computer, it will use more bandwidth than if you were simply creating a document. When we talk about ourselves and not our computers, bandwidth has a similar meaning. Human bandwidth refers to the total number of issues or amount of information a person can deal with at any given moment. It is the emotional or mental space you need to do something or think about something. When you have lots of bandwidth, you can deal with anything life throws at you. But when you are really busy or seriously worried, you might not have the bandwidth to deal with any additional issues. You simply do not have the time or mental space. We have other expressions that mean almost the same thing as being out of bandwidth. I can say I've hit my limit. I'm up to my neck, up to my eyes, or up to my ears. You can use any of those body parts. With work, responsibility, or fill in the blank. I am swamped. Bandwidth can also simply mean your attention span. For example, let's say you are sitting at your dinner table, thinking about an all-consuming problem. In this state, you are not able to focus on anything else. So if someone tries to ask you a question, you can tell them, "Sorry, I do not have the bandwidth to talk to you right now. Come back in about an hour." Now, sometimes we use the word bandwidth when we talk about our brains as computers. An article in Scientific American gives us a good example of this usage. Writer R. Douglas Fields discusses the development of an electronic device worn on the arm that permits the wearer to mentally interact with a computer. He writes, "This achievement opens and expands the bandwidth of the brain's output." Sometimes people use bandwidth to simply mean mental ability. I might say, "Oh, do not try to explain the issue to Alex. He doesn't have the bandwidth for something so difficult." Used this way, it means Alex is not intelligent enough to understand. It is a clear insult, so be careful using it that way. Now, let's hear bandwidth used in this short conversation between two friends.
Okay, let's go over the shopping list. We don't want to forget anything.
Do we have to do that right now?
No, but the party is next month, so time is running out.
There's plenty of time, and right now, I have a lot on my mind.
Come on. You can't be that busy.
Oh, really? Well, today at work, I lost all my documents when my computer crashed.
Well, you have backups of all your documents, don't you?
No. I had just finished writing 3 long stories. I'll have to work overtime the rest of the week or I'll miss my deadline.
Maybe we should change the subject.
Sure. This morning, my sister called to tell me that my great-aunt died.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Only met her once, when I was 10. But my mom can't take care of the funeral plans, so now I have to.
Oh, that's going to take a lot of time.
Yes, it is. But that's not all. Last night, my apartment flooded from a leak in the pipe. So I have to fix it by tomorrow because my boss is coming over for an important dinner meeting.
Wow, you are swamped. Really, up to your neck.
Tell me about it. So please understand if I don't have the bandwidth right now to plan for a party that is a month away.
Well, sounds like someone is out of patience as well as bandwidth.
And that's Words and Their Stories for this week. I'm Anna Mateo.
Viruses that hide in the brain might influence Alzheimer's disease. That is what researchers said in a new study that is expected to restart debate about what causes the brain-wasting disease. However, the findings do not prove viruses cause Alzheimer's. They also do not suggest that it can be passed from one person to another. A team led by researchers at New York's Mount Sinai Health System found that some viruses affect genes involved in Alzheimer's. Among those genes are two very common herpes viruses. The idea that infections earlier in life might somehow begin the process of getting Alzheimer's years later has been discussed for years, but the theory that Alzheimer's starts from sticky plaques that clog the brain has had more support. The study has some specialists saying it is time to look more closely at viruses. This is because of the failure of attempts to prevent the plaques. Dr. John Morris directs the Alzheimer's Research Center at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. He said, "With an illness this terrible, we cannot afford to dismiss all scientific possibilities." Morris was not involved in the new research.
Dr. Rudolph Tonzi is an Alzheimer's specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital. He said the study also agrees with growing evidence that the brain's ability to defend itself against viruses may be riskier than an actual infection. Tonzi was not involved in the recent study, but has performed related experiments with Dr. Robert Moir of Harvard. Their research has shown that sticky beta amyloid plaque captures germs by completely surrounding them. The researchers say that is why the plaque starts forming in the brain. The question remained, okay, in the Alzheimer brain, what are the microbes that matter? What are the microbes that start the plaque? Said Tonzi. The team from Mount Sinai and Arizona State University found some viral suspects by accident. Their study was not hunting viruses. It was looking for new drugs that would target Alzheimer's. The researchers were using complex genetic information from hundreds of brains. They wanted to compare differences between people who had died with Alzheimer's and people who had died completely free of Alzheimer's. The possibility that viruses were around came screaming out at us, said Mount Sinai genetic expert Joel Dudley. He was a leading author of the research published Thursday in the journal Neuron. The team found viral genetic material at far higher levels in the brains of people with Alzheimer's than in normal brains. Two human herpes viruses, known as HHV6A and HHV7, stood out. They infect most people during childhood, often with no symptoms, and then lie inactive in the body.
Since 1980, researchers have known that some common bacteria and viruses increased the likelihood of getting Alzheimer's. But it was never clear if the germs were bystanders or actively adding to the development of Alzheimer's. The new study used computer models to see how the viral genes intervened in human genes, proteins, and plaque buildup. They found a lot of interactions, suggesting that the viruses could even switch Alzheimer's-related genes on and off. To see if those interactions mattered, the researchers created mice that lack one molecule that the herpes virus seemed to destroy. The animals, researchers said, developed more of the amyloid plaques. Keith Fargo directs scientific programs for the Alzheimer's Association. He said the research makes a viral connection to Alzheimer's much more possible. But, he noted, the study will not affect how today's Alzheimer's patients are treated. The National Institutes of Health supported the study. The NIH is now giving money for a new study to see if an antiviral drug can help people who have both mild Alzheimer's and different herpes viruses. Just having a herpes virus does not mean you're going to get Alzheimer's, Tanzi said. It may not even have gotten into the brain. But, Tanzi added, the brain was always thought to be a sterile place. That's absolutely not true. I'm Susan Shand.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
When kidnappers attacked a woman on a Guatemala City street and seized her baby daughter, DNA testing came to the rescue. The tests helped reunite the girl with her mother after the baby was left at a religious center with no identification. DNA testing has also helped connect legally adopted children with their biological parents and immigrants in the United States with their families. Now, the technology is being used to bring together families separated at the U.S. border with Mexico. However, activists working for migrants say that using genetic tests in this way creates technical, legal, and even moral problems. Leading migrant rights groups have been rejecting offers by companies to donate testing supplies for free. Genetic tests have helped an organization called DNA Pro Kids reconnect more than 1,000 children with their families in Mexico, Nepal, and several other countries. They also reconnected the mother with her kidnapped daughter in Guatemala City. Jose Lorente, a professor at the University of Granada in Spain, started the organization. Lorente said he was moved by the children he saw on the streets in cities around the world. Many were victims of trafficking and had parents who were looking for them. Lorente said he hopes to set up a worldwide network of DNA testing laboratories to help children everywhere. This is a way to send a message to people trafficking children, he said. The message is, from now on, it is not going to be so easy to steal and traffic a child because he or she will be immediately identified. Lorente said DNA tests could help make sure that children coming across the U.S.-Mexico border are not being trafficked. U.S. officials already use such tests to confirm that immigrants seeking to join family members in the United States are related. Genetic testing led the U.S. State Department to suspend a program for refugees in 2008. At the time, officials identified suspected cases of cheating in the government's family reunification program. They tested about 3,000 people, mainly from Somalia, Ethiopia, and Liberia. They confirmed a parental connection in less than 20% of the cases. The program restarted in 2012. It now requires a DNA test to prove that an adult and child are related. New technology could permit those tests to be done at the border in as little as 90 minutes. Currently, law enforcement agencies are examining DNA tests that can connect a person in police detention to a detailed computer listing of known criminals. The same technology could be used to test migrants. Thermo Fisher Scientific has offered to donate $1 million worth of its testing technology to help reunite families separated at the border. Two ancestry companies, 23andMe and MyHeritage, also offered to donate their genetic tests to the effort. Both companies normally sell their products to persons interested in family history. Yet, migrant rights organizations are concerned about privacy. Fernanda Durand is with the migrant rights group CASA. She is worried that the government could use migrants' genetic information later without their approval. Normal DNA testing can only dependably identify parent, child, and sibling relationships. In refugee situations, activists say, it is not unusual for someone other than a child's biological parent to care for them, especially when a parent has been killed or detained. Ancestry companies' tests can find much more genetic information than normal DNA tests, and can identify wider relationships. But they can also provide more sensitive information, including health data. These tests also are not certified for this purpose by the organization that oversees DNA testing labs. 23andMe and MyHeritage say they are concerned about privacy and will offer the tests only to legal aid groups working with migrant families. However, those groups are still not 100% sure of the services. Jennifer Falcon is with the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services. She noted that separating parents from their children is bad enough. She added that you cannot solve one civil rights abuse by creating another possible violation of their privacy. I'm Phil Dierking. And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.